But I kind of want to throw it to you, Kenny. Is
everybody wants to throw it to each other,
yeah, right?
This is episode 325 of Bourbon Pursuit, the podcast featuring news, reviews, and interviews with people making the bourbon whiskey industry happen. I'm one of your hosts, Kenny Coleman, and before we start today's episode with the second installment on our four-part series of Is Bourbon Broken? Here's your weekly bourbon news update. If you, your store, or maybe a private group picked a George Remus barrel this past year, well, get ready to have it in your hands soon because Luxco announced that George Remus single barrel selections are headed to participating retailers in September. All single barrel selections for George Remus were done back in March of this past year for everyone, and they got to choose barrels between the 21% and the 36% rye mash bills, all coming from MGP. So that's good news for our Private Barrel Club members because we picked barrel number 572 back in March, and that's going to be in our hands very soon as well. Barton 1792 just wrapped up its $25 million warehouse expansion, which is an investment to increase barrel storage capacity by around 25%. This expansion on the distillery constructed of three new warehouses, and the first was built on-site at the historic distillery, which is the first one since 1963. Warehouse 33 was the first new warehouse to be built. It was completed back in February and now is nearly filled with new barrels of whiskey. Warehouse 34 was built this past summer and is about 70% filled with barrels. And Warehouse 35 was just completed with new barrels coming in just the next few weeks. These warehouses are made of traditional wood floors and wood storage ricking with metal siding. Warehouse 33 holds around 33,500 barrels, and warehouses 34 and 35 hold around 58,800 barrels each. And as just for a reference, the existing warehouses on the distillery's property hold respectively around 19,600 barrels each, so doubling and almost tripling capacity and size here. Now, we focus on bourbon a lot, but there is a rising star in the whiskey world, and that's the American single malt. Today, there is nothing that legally defines what an American single malt category is, but that may change soon. The American Single Malt Whiskey Commission has been lobbying for this change for some time, and there was a newsletter that was distributed last week that said they anticipate the TTB may put this into law by spring of next year. And this would consist of a few requirements, such as made from 100% of malted barley that was mashed, distilled, and matured at one distillery in the United States. It was matured in oak casks no larger than 700 liters or around 185 gallons, distilled no more than 160 proof, and bottled at no less than 80 proof. Horse Soldier Bourbon, which was created by retired members of the U.S. Special Forces, who were among the first to enter Afghanistan following the terrorist attacks back on September 11, 2001, are now planning to build a new distillery and visitor destination in Pulaski County, Kentucky, otherwise known as Somerset, Kentucky. This is a $200 million tourism project that will boast a 27,580-foot square foot distillery and visitor center, a 5,000-person amphitheater, a 500-person outdoor space, 3,200-square-foot wedding chapel, an activity center, shops, and more, while creating 50 new jobs for the area. The company has also been approved by the Kentucky Tourism Development Finance Authority for around $30 million in incentives for this new project. Now moving on to some bourbon release news. Maker's Mark is releasing its latest in the wood finishing series called FAE-02, or Fatty Acid Esters, and this comes after the release of FAE-01. Maker's Mark has never chill-filtered its whiskey, and that was a decision to allow the classic bourbon to retain its signature character and depth of flavor by leaving natural present fatty acid esters. FAE-02 is produced using fully matured cask-strength Maker's Mark that was finished in a secondary barrel that was double heat-treated with virgin oak French barrel staves that undergo an infrared exposure prior to a flaming toast finish. It's bottled at 109.1 proof, in the Maker's Mark Wood Finishing Series 2021 limited edition release of FAE-02 is now rolling out in limited quantities to retailers across the country, and it will also retail for $60. If you're interested in getting FAE-02 along with FAE-01, it will also be included in the September shipment of The Whiskey Drop, which is Maker's Mark's new direct-to-consumer program. Few Spirits is introducing the Few 10th Anniversary Straight Bourbon Whiskey. This is aged for 6 years and is bottled at 93 proof. This extremely limited product with only 3,900 bottles available will hit shelves in September and will only be available exclusively in Illinois and through direct-to-consumer channel at buyfewspirits.com for $50. So last week, we kicked off a series where we're analyzing Bourbon & Banter's articles on Is Bourbon Broken? It really sparked up a lot of chatter, and we've been getting all kinds of messages through email and YouTube and Instagram comments. Well, this next installment looks at the secondary market. The prices of bourbon have been growing immensely, and who knows if the prices will ever drop. Do we ever think there's going to be an end in sight that consumers will stop buying in the secondary market? Or should companies just start adjusting their prices accordingly? Well, we tackle all this and a heck of a lot more. So with that, enjoy today's episode. And now here's Fred Minnick with Above the Char.
I'm Fred Minnick, and this is Above the Char. This week's idea comes from Eric Ashley, who writes on fredminnick.com, I'm writing you today in regards an above the char question related to using bourbon as a mixer. It seems that when people talk about certain bourbons, they will sometimes note that they are better for mixing rather than sipping. Is this an indication that a bourbon is subpar, or do producers purposely design some of their bourbon for mixing? Eric's just straight jumping into the inside information. So Eric, beautiful question. And it was kind of known about me that when I was reviewing whiskeys for Whiskey Advocate, if I really didn't like something, I would say it'd be great for cocktails, it'd be good for mixing, or be good in a punch. And, you know, people would notice that, like, you know, we noticed that on your 84-point scores, you know, you really said it needs to be in a cocktail or something like that. And keep in mind, you know, when I'm reviewing for someone else, I'm following their standards of, like, how the review should go and their point system and everything like that. So I would often be creative where I would be doing my reviews to, you know, be a little bit more transparent how I felt about it. And that was one of them, as I would say, be good for cocktails. Now, that's an honest thing to say, because I'm using a very different bourbon for my cocktails than I am for sipping. That's not to say the things that I'm sipping would not be great in a bourbon cocktail, because they would be. It's just, it's an economic thing. So if I'm spending $70 on a bourbon, I don't want to be pouring that in a cocktail. I want the cocktail to be with something that's great, but, you know, a little bit more cost effective. And, you know, it's kind of an economic thing in some ways, but also there are bourbons that I just don't want to sip neat. You know, there'll be corn forward, there'll be a heavy, like, starch note or a heavy wood note in there. And when you mix it with other ingredients, those notes dissipate, and the beautiful notes that are inside them, like a caramel or a vanilla or a cinnamon, you know, they can pop a little bit more with the right kind of syrup, the right kind of citrus. Of course, there are brands that do create product just to focus on the cocktail market. And you will notice these tend to be like the under $30, you know, under $30 price range. And while COVID has taken away a lot of bar experiences, the bar is built on price point. So if the more expensive a bourbon is, the higher price the cocktail will be. And it's very difficult to get somebody to spend more than $12 on a cocktail. You can pull it off in places like New York, Vegas, Chicago, but in Louisville, if you have a cocktail that's more than $12, boy, you better be bringing some absolute beastly qualities in that drink. You know, it's just not a market that will support a lot of $14, $15 cocktails. But you will see that, like, Old Forester 100, which, you know what? I would argue it is not a bad sipper, but that price point allows it to be an excellent, excellent mixer in a cocktail shaker. Bullet was basically designed and marketed to bartenders in a way that no other brands really focused on. And so that's why you see a lot of Bullet cocktails out there, is because they put so much emphasis on bartenders being their own chemists behind the bar. And of course, you know, brands like Evan Williams, Jim Beam, Jack Daniels, they have a very specific focus. They're going for, like, Coca-Cola. So they're, like, skipping that cocktail line, and they're trying to be that and one. So bourbon and ginger ale, bourbon and Coca-Cola. So you have various grades of how people market their bourbons. And I think it's kind of a trend that's going away a little bit because of COVID. You know, so many bars don't get that same kind of interaction with their communities that they used to. And I hope that once everything kind of gets back to normal, we will see the rise of the craft bourbon cocktail bar again. But I think this is a great question. And you got to learn a little inside scoop about my old days of reviewing. And I appreciate that question, Eric. If you would like to be like Eric and have your question read on Bourbon Pursuit, hit me up on fredminnick.com. That's fredminnick.com. Click that contact button and just shoot me your idea. If I like it, I'll read it on the air and do my best to answer the question. Until next week, cheers.
From their bar to yours, Chad and Sarah of the popular YouTube channel It's Bourbon Night bring you their favorite at-home old-fashioned mix with the new Elemental Elixirs Golden Hour Syrup. It's a custom-made syrup with notes of bold black tea, warm spices, and orange zest. All you need is your favorite whiskey and ice. No bitters needed. One bottle makes 16 drinks, so that's only $1 a cocktail before you add your own whiskey. They can also be enjoyed in other cocktails or spirits, mocktails, coffee, tea, and anything you can think of. It's crafted locally in Lexington, Kentucky, and you can get your bottle now at whiskeyambitions.com. It's that time of the year where everybody's starting to make their vacation plans on visiting Kentucky, the mecca of bourbon. And if you are coming to Kentucky, you need to make sure you visit us at Pursuit Spirits in Louisville. We're right in the heart of Clifton, near Butchertown and Nulu, and only just a few miles away from downtown Louisville. But when you do come, you need to book your experience to go do our whole shebang. This is the one that's really the star of the show. You get a full-on tasting. You get to do your own personal barrel selection experience. And you get to grab a whiskey thief and fill your bottle directly from the barrel. We're doing something completely brand new that nobody else is doing here in Bourbon Country. Plus, you get a free sweet tasting glass at the end of it. I guarantee you, you're going to end up being one of the many people that's also leaving us a 5-star review. So make sure you come and check us out. You can book your reservation by going to pursuitspirits.com and clicking the Visit Us button.
It's that time again to get bourbon strong with Give270. Purchase your $50 tickets for your chance to win from our 50 bourbon prizes. Don't miss out on rare bottles and grand prizes like the legendary Pappy Set, a Weller Rainbow, and the Blood Oath Trilogy. Hurry, only 3,000 tickets are available. Single bottle winners go back in for the grand prize draw. Will you win the ultimate Pappy Set or one of our other incredible prizes? Get your tickets now at Give270.org. Charitable gaming license ORG 000-2703.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Bourbon Pursuit, the official podcast of bourbon. We're moving on now with part two of our Is Bourbon Broken series. In part one last week, we covered the consumer problem, and credit for the series on Is Bourbon Broken goes to Brent Joseph, a contributing writer to Bourbon and Banter. And again, over this four-part series, we're going to evaluate Brent's opinion piece on Is Bourbon Broken, and we're going to add our commentary to expand further on where we see bourbon trending. And in part two of this Is Bourbon Broken series, we're going to cover the secondary market. Ba-ba-bum. And in Brent's article covering the secondary, he said, if you really have to have that bottle, you're forced to buy it on the secondary where people are paying 4 to 8 times the retail price. Brent says people go as far as paying the delivery driver of a local grocery store chain to tip them off when Old Forester birthday bourbon is being delivered to each door. And then that person has multiple bottles that they eventually end up on the secondary market. This is a behavior that has proliferated in bourbon and will probably continue for some time. In this episode, we're going to look at the secondary market, how it affects your ability to get the bottle that you want, and the ever-changing price increases. So this show is probably no stranger to the secondary market, and we've covered it plenty of times and have outright said it that it is also part of the bourbon culture. Now I want to take this a step further and dive into Brett's first comment here, and that is, if you really have to have that bottle, you're forced to buy it in the secondary market. Is that true in today's market? What do you all feel?
Absolutely. Unless you're willing to camp or win a lottery, or like you said, and I've done this before, I paid a manager to, not paid him, but I gave him concert tickets,
some kind of tickets,
football tickets and stuff to say, hey, you know, I got these bottles in, you know, are you interested in them? But, Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, here in Kentucky, you're definitely going to. Maybe in other parts of the country, it's different, but here...
Definitely not like liquor control states. Let's also set that aside. If you're in Ohio or Pennsylvania, probably not the same exact thing, but...
Yeah, so I think so.
What was the question? When it's a secondary market, I don't even know what that is. So I'm going to
bottle you want.
Never heard of it before.
I don't know what that is. If it's a bottle you want, you have to go to the secondary market.
If you have to have that bottle, if a new release is coming out and it is just something that you're like, wow, that is some double digit numbers and it's from a distillery I really like.
We had this with Stag last year. I really enjoyed it from our media samples we got. And I was like, I really want a bottle of this. And I knew I wasn't going to get a liquor store. I knew I wasn't going to get it in a camp or lottery because I'm not going. So where did I go? Secondary market.
I would qualify this a little bit. There's enough like online stores that are selling these like rare bottles now. I mean, you have to pay stupid prices.
Way over secondary usually.
Well, yeah, it's over secondary. I think that if you want to pay an arm and a leg, there's some of those stores out there that you can buy online. But for the most part, you do have to find a way to creatively buy it in a non-traditional three-tier system. But I still don't understand this secondary market you speak of. I'm not familiar with
that. Never heard of it. Never heard of it.
Or you can do now with vintage laws, you can go to, Justin's House of Bourbon or somewhere,
Boy, they got that stuff airtight. Yeah, you can do it. You gotta be in Kentucky. They can't ship out unless you're in like one of like
seven states. And I think also, even going back to even what I pointed maybe before, yes, it's a brick and mortar store. You're gonna pay more than secondary, but you have a few things. You've got overhead, you got payment of people, and you've got people that have probably validated the product.
Yeah, it's a clean, simple transaction. You don't have to worry about shipping it cross country or getting a fake, or because they're doing a lot of effort to make sure that they're
correct,
legit. So
there's also something's happened in the past year. There's a company called GoPuff that's been acquiring licenses from like BevMo, and they bought Liquor Barn, and so they are now sitting on like 450 liquor stores across the country, and so a massive amount of buying power. And I imagine that they're probably trying to find a way to get this incredible Pappy selection that's here at Liquor Barn across state lines to, say, a store in Missouri or California or something like that. I think things might get spread out a little bit more, and I'm sure we're going to talk about this, but the secondary market is a symptom of a flawed... It's a symptom of a flawed system. The three-tier system is why we have this.
And I think it's a flaw, to your point in the previous episode, of pricing.
Exactly.
A lot of these bottles are priced incorrectly, and it allows for, flipping to happen. And I say that too, that, distillers like Willett, they're trying to find what is the threshold that somebody's willing to pay and still make money on the secondary market, and they still haven't found it yet. With, $1,000, $1,500 price tags on bottles. And so, but I think, if you started to put, like antique collection, for example, at $300 a bottle, $400, would that deter some flippers, saying that's just too much cash up front to, versus like $75 to $100 if they're getting it at, retail?
Yeah. I think it would still go up. I mean, honestly, everything that we have seen in like legitimate auctions as well is that stuff is just going up. And I think there's got to be a ceiling. I don't know what it is, but Pappy 23 is the amount of money you have to spend to get a bottle of that, whether in a liquor store or on the secondary market or on one of those crazy online sites. I mean, it's an arm. I mean, it's above $5,000 in some places, and in there, we're not even talking Stitzel Weller stocks anymore,
It is just the brand that comes along with it. Ryan, to kind of talk about your idea of price and what this goes into it. I mean, as the saying goes, a fool and his money are going to soon part. Do you feel that it's foolish for people to go onto a secondary market and pay $400 for a bottle that would only be costing or should only cost $75? You think this is part of just free trade in America?
Yeah, I think it's free market. If that's what somebody's willing and they think that, I think value is always you know, when we first started our reviews for Whiskey Quickie, we were going to do pricing, but then it's so subjective to whoever, you know, if somebody really likes that bottle or wants it, then they're willing. So it's all subjective to whoever's buying it. So I don't think it necessarily foolish. I mean, I've done it plenty of times where there's a bottle I just really enjoyed it. I knew the only way to get it was to pay an asinine amount, but I thought it was worth it. You know, I got it on my shelf, and when I have friends over or if I have this special event, it's a bottle I can pull and I'm happy to have it and happy to pay that. But yeah, it just, I don't think it's foolish.
Yeah. I mean, I thought it was foolish at first when I first started joining these groups, and I was like, who is paying $120 for a bottle from 1973 from old granddad that has a sticker on it that's $7.99?
That would have been
cents.
Me.
Well, I mean, granted, I was unaware of, you know, the whole Dusty scene at the time, but I was like, who in the right mind would do that? And now those bottles are worth $400, $500, $600.
One of the most fascinating jackups I recall was when Heaven Hill Bottled and Bond went out of circulation, the six-year-old. And at the time, they didn't say they were going to be bringing it back as a seven-year-old and repackaged and all that. They just said, it's gone. And you started seeing all this Heaven Hill Bottled and Bond six-year-old for $70. And I was like, what the heck, man? I can get it for, you know, 12. And that I did. But it's like, that is the, but that's if I live in Kentucky. If you're in Rhode Island, if you are in Montana, those are places that you're not getting Heaven Hill Bottle and Bond, no matter what. So the secondary market was a creation because people who want those products can't get them in their home market. And so this was born out of that. And, you know, we're not talking about, you know, selling shoes here. We're talking about a highly regulated item that every, after Prohibition, basically, we never really legitimately ended Prohibition. We just passed the buck to the states to make decisions on alcohol. So the alcohol decisions are made by state, and states work together to block things. And thus, the three-tier system was created. And for those listening that aren't as familiar, it is basically you have a supplier, that's the distiller, you have a distributor, that gives it to the retailer or the on-premise, which would be a restaurant or bar. And that system has been held in place, and they have become an enormous conglomerate of billions and billions of dollars, and they keep it in place, and they block a lot of things that allow that person in Rhode Island to get a bottle shipped directly to them from Kentucky, from a licensed retailer or from the distiller or something, because everybody wants their piece, and those people who want the piece don't like that secondary market one bit.
Yeah, and you know, even more so on the secondary market, I want to kind of also go back to Brent's article here, because talking about the delivery driver with bottles of Old Forester birthday bourbon that ended up on the secondary because somebody wanted to pay and tip him off, this isn't uncommon. Like, we've heard about this before. I know firsthand of individuals that would go around in the city and they would drop off a sheet of paper and say, this is what I'm paying for Pappy. Give me a phone call. And that's hard for a store to turn away because it's an easy incentive. It's an easy sale, and they're going to make more than what they probably thought they were going to.
They also don't have the headache, you know,
but exactly.
They don't have the headache of like, what am I going to get by Pappy?
And, you know,
we'll set up a raffle or locker, yeah. You know.
And we'll talk about more about distribution and retail in part three. But when we talk about just the behavior of what the secondary market's driving, what would we be able to see? Like, how could we change something in this current climate that would deter people from doing some type of behavior like this?
Which behavior?
Of like, being able to go through and say, I'm going to go to every single retail store and I'm gonna be like, you know, that bottle of birthday bourbon you're getting for $60 wholesale, I'm going to give you $250 for it. And I'm going to take it. I'm going to turn around and sell for $400.
Yeah, I don't know what you do. I mean, because you could do the state run, you know, where you're setting prices and, you know, that. But, you know, a lot of these small mom and pop stores, they need that extra cash and extra revenue from these limited releases. And so you don't want to take that away from them. There's really just no good answer, I don't think.
And it's going to vary by state, too. There's going to be some states that have laws on that sort of thing. But I don't know. I don't even know if it's a if I own a liquor store, I don't know if I'm just selling it like that to get it out of the way, or I'm calling up one of my best customers and say, hey, Pappy's in, you got a bottle. Yeah, do you want it? I mean, because you just, you get these rare bottles, and those poor people who own the liquor stores just have all the headaches that come with them. And then when they don't get the bottles and they say, well, I don't have the bottles anymore, I can't help you. And so there's like a certain fiery vinegar to them, you know, because they didn't move enough product to warrant getting a bottle.
Yeah, no, I get it. And that was a tough question. It really was, because I'm trying to make it really solve an issue that is never going to be solved.
You're trying to solve a nuanced, and it's like any problem. You're trying to solve a nuanced problem or discussion with a blanket resolution.
You're specifically talking about the people taking money from someone to sell to.
No, he's just saying like, okay, I'm a store owner and there's a guy that's more than likely flipping, but he's offering me a certain price per bottle that I can get more from him than just putting the bottle on the shelf or dealing with all the headache. I can say, okay, here's one buyer I can give all my allocation to. It's a simple, clean transaction, but that guy or girl is going to go and sell them on the secondary market.
I mean, really, my intention was to look at the example of somebody going around and paying off the delivery driver of like, this is where Old Forester Birthday Bourbon is going to be. And that then fueling the secondary market only because this person is just doing it for the pure flip of it.
I don't know if you can change any of that. And honestly, that the guy driving the truck, you know, this is one where like I have a pretty hard stance on a lot of this, but the guy driving the truck, I mean, if he can get, you know, $100, he's not in the equation in any way, and all he's got to do is make a tip or tell him where it's going to be or whatever. I don't know. I have a soft spot there, and same with the managers, and they don't always make a lot of money, and they're not doing anything really that's illegal. You know, they're selling stuff to someone. I don't know. I don't really have a good answer here. And this is the whole secondary market thing. I still don't know what this is.
Well, we'll take a different approach to this, and we'll look at distillery releases. We know that a few years ago, when it was bourbon festival time, that you'd be able to go to Heaven Hill and Four Roses and Willett. You'd be able to stand in line and get a bunch of these bottles. And most of the time, you'd had friends that were there, or you'd be able to go through the line twice, or like figure out some way around it. The KDA has actually stepped up in the past few years, and now there's a system in place where anytime you go to say, I know for sure, when you go to Heaven Hill, you want to purchase something, you have to get your driver's license scanned, and that goes into a database and a record of what you purchased on which day. And it also helps them put a limit to say, oh, you were here last month. We limit these to, you know, one per person per month. Is there anything more that distilleries can do to take action against having their products flipped on the secondary market?
I think that's probably the best one. And maybe that's your answer to the previous question, is that maybe there's a large database with every purchase of, but it's like, but then you're adding an extra cost and expense to liquor stores having the equipment.
Well, also, I mean, guys, you know, we have the Fourth Amendment on the books, you know, for a reason. There's a lot of privacy issues there as well. And there's, I don't know the whole legality of all that is, but, and also, you know, the distilleries, and this is a part that nobody wants to talk about. And this is why the distributors have been flexing so much the past 10 years, is that the distillers are selling rare bottles directly to consumers that used to go through retailers, that used to go through distributors. And so everyone here is fighting for their turf. That's all it is. And that's why the secondary market was born. And so like in terms of like stopping that flipper from flipping it, I just don't know. Like I honestly, the whole measure of, you know, scanning the ID, I think that might even be, if anyone ever were to legally challenge that, I'm sure that they probably would have a pretty strong case.
I mean, I would say that it's your choice to buy the bottle or not. I mean, it's the same way that you choose to use Facebook or not. You don't have to use it, but if you're going to use it, your data is going to get used. And I think that's just part of
the, as long as you agree to that, that's it. That's it. It's like you have, if someone signs a form or whatever, or check a box, you agree to it. But there's certain things This is great. Where we'd love to have
maybe
our lawyer.
Be a sign on the door and says, like, as soon as you walk in the store, you waive your rights to
you waive all your identities. kind of like
you, we are filming. So
yeah,
you'll end up on Pappygate. I don't know how they stop it.
Yeah, I mean, it's tough to think that distillers are going to be able to try to do more and more and more.
Oh, and by the way, the company that did do something to stop it and has been Sazerac. They hired lawyers and worked with Facebook to shut down secondary markets. There's not a brand that's not a company more vilified than for doing that. So, I think it's. The other way to stop it is pricing. And
the other way to stop it is just to shut it down. I guess that's the other way they do want to go with it. And that's not the way I would go.
But. No, Dave Pickerel was like, this is how we stop it. We price our bottle $600. And so that's why, their Boss Hog release is a $600 bottle. And it's because they priced it to not get on the secondary market. Michter's is the same way. Michter's is very properly priced for their limited edition stuff. You know, their stuff is well priced. So that's how you could, stop it. And every product has a point where it can't flip for more because the market will not bear it. So,
yeah. And I think that's, we'll go ahead and jump into that too, because, the other side of the secondary market, good or bad, is that there are distillers in there and they see what's going on. So we do see that prices are being adjusted to what we see in the market today. So at what point does the consumer see the ceiling? I mean, do you think we've seen a ceiling in regards to this? And maybe not even that is, do we feel it's fair for distilleries to be in these groups to be able to see what prices are going on so they can adjust what's going on?
Well, they,
and maybe it, and is that considered, I mean, that's just like, that's like saying
the same groups are trying to shut down.
Well, that's saying like, it's just saying like, oh, like Tony in the inside of the mob, he's doing this thing, like I got to get my tips from inside of the mob.
Hey, how do you know Tony?
Yeah, and it's like I got to get my tips from inside of this black and gray market to figure out how I run my legitimate business.
You know what's funny is that, and this is when we were in the heyday, in the prime of the secondary market, a very popular distiller owner reached out to me asking me what his bottles were going for. And I was like, I didn't think much of it at the time. And then they came out with those prices of what those bottles, I was like, oh, fuck. You know, it's like I didn't even think about that. I think all of us who really played in the secondary market, we probably all have a regret or two, but there will continue to be distillers in the secondary market sites because it is active, living, breathing data of the market. And essentially, it's an unregulated Wall Street. You can see pricing happening unlike anywhere else. You can see what things are worth. And I'm telling you, the industry should have embraced it and figured out a way to channel it into a proper system versus trying to shut it down. Because it's just like, it's just like anything else. When you take out a process that's working for a large chunk of the population, it's going to splinter out. And so now what I see on my Instagram page and your Instagram page, you post a bottle that you like, you do a review on it. Some Instagram handle that popped up 15 minutes ago is like, hey, I got a bottle. You want to buy one? Hey, you want to buy one? It's like there's a bunch of drug dealers now just, moving in on the turf and plucking people off one by one. So there's no longer a community. It's a bunch of assholes just trying to flip.
Yeah, and I don't know if it's, I think I've made this point before, we have, if it's causation or correlation, but I'm just not sure that a lot of these brands would be where they are today without the secondary market. Pappy was big, but it wasn't as big until it was on the secondary market. Brands like Old Scout, OKI, Willett, they were good, but they weren't what they were today until the secondary market.
The brands like Mike Drop and Smoke Wagon never would have existed without a secondary market.
And
absolutely.
And even the craze of Weller, it's like, I'm just not sure that it would all be there without the secondary market.
And it was marketing. It was marketing for people. And I, to this day, I don't understand why, you know, I understand why the Van Winkle family did not like it, because they're not seeing, you know, they're looking at it as like, it's going for $2,000. We're not getting that, you know, but like, I don't understand as like the larger companies in the Van Winkles are over here, right? So I think of them very differently than I think of the entities, the companies. Like that was living, breathing marketing for them. They just kind of let it go and they wanted to shut it down. All over the hang up of was like someone didn't have a license to sell it. And that's true, but there was a way that the industry could have figured it out. There's an app, there's something that could have been worked out there, but everyone's got to have their piece of the pie. You know, we're talking billions of dollars. And really the scary secondary market isn't our little bourbon groups. It's what's happened into the Dominican Republic and places where fake alcohol is killing people, or it's going into like downtown Brooklyn where someone has stolen a truck and is selling it, selling a Woodford out of the back of a truck in a parking lot. That's where the scary stuff is, not in the Facebook groups.
Yeah, Ryan, I couldn't agree with you more that, and Fred, you too, is to look at this was a huge marketing engine. And a lot of these groups and a lot of these distilleries, a lot of these brands, they probably wouldn't get the shelf space nor the attention if it wasn't to see like, what are people trading these for? Granted, some might've been shill bidding at the time, but you know, it did have that sort of organic growth to it that just happened from a community standpoint. I kind of want to turn it around just a little bit to kind of one of my original questions is, you know, when distilleries are sitting there and they're looking at market data and they're looking at what's happening in the secondary market, is it an ethical practice for them to be able to do that?
I mean, like we said, you sign away your rights when you get on Facebook and all that. So, I mean,
well, I'll tell you, the pharmaceutical industry, you know, took a playbook out of the Colombian cartels in the 90s. So it happens in other genres of business. And I will say that, you know, the people who are, you know, we're talking about the distillers, but, you know, one of the key people here are the massive flippers who have made a lot of money off of it. I look at that very differently as I do as like a guy trading a bottle or, you know, selling a bottle, a single bottle. But this is so complex, and it does begin with the distillers. And they are using the secondary market, they are studying it. They're studying it for their own, you know, marketing purposes. And they're also studying it for their own prevention methods. And is that a good way to run a business? Hell, I don't know, man.
Yeah, I mean, I don't necessarily think it's unethical, but I don't know. I mean, it's free data that's out there, so it's like you might as well do something with it, you know, to benefit your business. But
the best thing about some of them is like they would have the spreadsheets, right? And so you could go in to look at the historical data of what something sold for. But really, there's so much stuff is moving into like Bonhams and Whiskey Auctioneer. Things like that are legitimate auctions that are just the same as secondary. And there, you want to tell me that Christie's has a license to ship all over the world? No, you know, but they're not batting an eye at that. The data is very, very real in a lot of places. And if it's available and you can use it to the benefit of your company, you know, go for it. But I think a lot of what's happened is that they've also used that as like an investigative practice. So, you know, some companies have gotten in there and saying like, all right, this is a guy. Well, you know, it's kind of like the bad check guy at a cashier stand, slap his face up in the distillery counter and don't sell to him.
So I'll take, you brought up auction houses. I think this is a fun way to kind of take this. I'll try to collect my thoughts here a little bit too, because a lot of consumers, and not a lot of consumers, some consumers out there, they collect very high value bottles, whether it's old wax top, block crack letter, Willets. No, this is the point, is that these collectors, they don't want to crack them open. They hold them. They buy it because they look at it as an investment and they will one day take it to auction. Now, there is absolutely nothing wrong with doing that, because most of the time they're buying bottles that are already in the $1,000 to $10,000 price range, which is going to be out of the realm for most consumers there. Now, auction houses, they take some of these bottles because most of the time people with these types of level collections, they're not going to just go and willy-nilly tell it to John and drop it off at UPS and hope for the best. Now, when we think about the value that are going to these and you say like, oh, I've got this bottle of 2012 Pappy 23 that we know was Stitzel Weller stock, how does that change the perception of what a bottle might be, like a 2021 release of a Pappy 23? If you're anything like me, then you can't get enough about bourbon. And that's why I'm a subscriber to Bourbon Plus magazine. Bourbon Plus is a quarterly publication that tells the stories from the heart of bourbon. The farmers who grow the grain, the distillers who labor over the process, and the people, like you and me, who raise their glasses to celebrate it all. Subscribe to Bourbon Plus magazine today at bourbonplus.com, that's P-L-U-S.com, and use code PURSUIT at checkout for $5 off your subscription. Customers are rushing to your store. Do you have a point-of-sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. Shopify POS is your command center for your retail store. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify has everything you need to sell in person. And with Shopify, you get a powerhouse selling partner that effortlessly unites your in-person and online sales into one source of truth. Track every sale across your business in one place and know exactly what's in stock. Connect with customers in line and online. Shopify helps you drive store traffic with plug-and-play tools built for marketing campaigns from TikTok to Instagram and beyond. And you can get hardware that fits your business. Take payments by smartphone, transform your tablet into a point-of-sale system, or use Shopify's POS Go mobile device for a battle-tested solution. Plus, Shopify's award-winning 24/7 help is there to support your success every step of the way. Do retail right with Shopify. Sign up for $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/bourbon, all lowercase, and go to shopify.com/bourbon to take your retail business to the next level today. Shopify.com/bourbon. When we think about the value that are going to these and you say like, oh, I've got this bottle of 2012 Pappy 23 that we know was Stitzel Weller stock, how does that change the perception of what a bottle might be, like a 2021 release of a Pappy 23? Because most people, they'll go and they're like, oh, this thing went for auction for $8,000. That means my 2022 release has got to be worth at least $8,000. Are auctions offsetting or like fluctuating the prices of what they think bottles should be worth for newer releases?
And also a lot of them are charity auctions. And full caveat, I have curated probably 20 or so auctions. I have served as auctioneer on stuff and gotten bottles to sell for north of 10,000, sold barrels for 75,000. And these are things that are usually tied to a charity. And we should separate charity auction, which has a very emotional pull to it, to the profit auction. And the profit auctions have now tapped into the Chinese market. And the Chinese billionaires are starting to bid on American whiskey. And when I started seeing some of these old OFC bottles that would go for like $2,500 once upon a time, they're now like $10,000-$15,000 or more. I mean, they're going to ridiculous amounts and great vintage stuff. But one story I think we can all appreciate, there's a guy that has one of the very first Pappies. And he is holding on to that thing to when the right time to sell is. And when that time is, you know, he's going to get a lot of money. But there are people who absolutely see that as mortgage, college tuition. And, everyone has one of those bottles and in the collector's world. But I'm of the belief that I still believe that this is to be enjoyed. Call me crazy. But I say crack that thing open and, sip it. But if you really need the money, there are legitimate auctions that will definitely sell them for you and take half.
So how does forgive my ignorance, but how does an auction get a pass versus, a secondary market?
So a charity auction, will be like...
Not for a charity, but for the profit. For-profit auctions.
So how do they get a pass? They've been doing it in wine circles. They'll have a special license. And the crux of a lot of it comes down to shipping. And they'll always say that, you'll come pick up. But you know, I've been told that they often ship. So there is a legality thing there for sure, but they seem to have gotten past it over the years, because a lot of them have been grandfathered into wine, but wine gets regulated differently than spirits anyway. But in terms of like how it works, like if you have a collection and it gets valued at $100,000, you're only going to see $50,000-$60,000. I mean, there's going to be a big chunk of commission that comes out of that. You know, when I have people reach out to me, I've curated a couple like whiskey libraries and stuff. When people have reached out to me with a special bottle, I'll tell them, like, you could sell this at auction and it'd go for $15,000. I mean, it's a very rare bottle of 1909. This is why it's special. This is why it's important. But you're only going to see 8,000-9,000 of that. You know, my client will give you 10. And so you'll make more money selling directly to this person than you will at an auction house. But that's in like the really rare and qualified stuff, you know, that I can do that.
But is that illegal to do it with that person versus an auction house?
For that sale, no, because it'd be like they have like a vintage license where they can purchase from people.
Gotcha.
So yeah, it's within everything.
What
I
if
do,
it was me? I don't.
we wouldn't be having this conversation. But everything I do,
we know you don't have that money, right?
Yeah, above exactly. Above. None of this is relevant to me, anyways.
The secondary market, it tends to be more about the modern stuff. Stetzel Weller had a nice run, and then Schombrock very publicly went sober, and then the market for Stetzel Weller dropped, and suddenly bottles that were 5,000 I could get for 4,000. I was like, was one guy like causing the entire demand for Stetzel Weller from
he had a lot of it
pre 64, but you know, that's one of the peculiar things to me about all of this. I did an auction for the Kentucky Derby Museum once, and I had a 1971 distilled, you know, bottle 1971, something like that, in an old rip bottle that Julian Van Winkle had donated, signed it and everything. The whiskey was amazing. It was like, you would never get this whiskey. It auctioned off for like $900.
Oh God, it pains me to.
A bottle.
I want to go back in time, find the DeLorean, I'll go bid on it.
A bottle of Old Rip 10, fresh off the line, auction for like $1,900. So a modern day Old Rip 10-year-old versus what was, I think it was a 15-year-old Stetzel Weller in one of Julian's handpicked bottles from 71, went for $900.
This goes back to last week's episode of educating the consumer. Like, yeah. There is something that went wrong there.
But you're that's really still, wrong. It's still, that's what the secondary market has always been fascinating to me, because people, to me, don't spend the money in the right places. And it almost mimics the ridiculous demand for Blantons, you know? It's the people aren't buying Blantons on there, but they're spending how much for first edition Mic Drop or first edition Kentucky Owl, you know, things like that. I mean, this just, it makes no sense for that to go more than, say, an ancient age 10-year-old from 1975, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, let's talk about this a little more, because the secondary market does drive prices. I mean, we've been talking about prices a lot, and I think we should really hit on it some more, is that it does drive up prices. And now we are starting to see things that come out from market, because anybody that is now coming out with a new product, you know, whether it's Wheaton's Cove, whether it's Blue Run Spirits, I mean, they are starting to hit these high dollar marks. And this is for stuff that was, you know, it's sourced liquid. We all know where it's coming from. We all know what you can probably get for it. But they're probably paying attention to the market data, and they're coming out with a high price tag, fancy label, and sometimes very little information about what's inside of the package. And at what point does a regular consumer become confused, or is it just testing the market and kind of seeing what works? Because, I mean, if you think about it, if I'm an everyday consumer and I go and I see a bottle of 1792 full proof for $48, and I look to my left and I see this other one that's $199, and I'm like, Damn,
but your average consumer is not going to know that they're the same, exactly. You know, similar juice inside the bottle.
And so at what point, I'm just saying that most of the time is that when people are looking at pricing these things, they're not doing it just because of their sourced cost of liquid or anything like that, or their cost of goods. Granted, that has some influence into it, but to price it that much higher, I mean, Ryan, we're in the business. Like, sure, we know what it costs. We know where we can make enough margin that keeps us happy. But some people also look at the data and they'll want to push it and they'll say, well, I know what this type of stuff, even like a 1792 foolproof with one a great sticker on it, will probably go for $200. I mean, it might go in some cases. So why couldn't this product go for $200? And is this fair to the consumer at the end of the day? I guess that's another question.
This whole pricing things we were talking about in the previous episode, and it's tough because you want to capture... Aged whiskey is very rare and hard to come by. And so you want to capture the most dollar amount you can for that. But at the same time, you want to not price yourself out for long term for your brand, to where if you keep raising the prices and keep an upper trajectory, then it's like you got to have that consumer coming back. For an everyday consumer, yes, it would be confusing because you have, you know, Kentucky Par, then you have... what's some others, chicken cock, and you know, all of them having the same 15 year to 12 year juice, and they're all priced differently, and but they're the same exact product. And you know, that's the education part. Most people buying these bottles are probably like, well, you know, I'm gonna buy it as a gift for someone. I don't care if it's,
yeah,
you know, yeah, you may say that other bottle's good, but you've said this before, they don't want to buy it because it's cheap, you know.
Yeah,
you know, and this just has a perceived value that it's better. I'm trying to see where I'm going with this.
But, I'll throw another one out at you then. Should we do a social experiment? Should we go get some 5 and 6 year old bourbon, find the nicest glass that we can possibly do, put it out there for $500 and just see what happens?
Yeah, I guess we could do our next United batch. Just say it's going from $65 to
different names.
We would definitely. No, it would definitely be some shadow company. Like it wouldn't be anything you'd heard of before.
Keep it far, far away from you too, because I don't need the phone calls.
Old Nazareth.
What the hell are Kitty and Ryan doing? So I will say that, you know, what's interesting is, look, the secondary market is not dead by any means. The flippers who were making their money are still doing quite well. They created their own networks, if you will, and the system continues. But it's gone from being like 100% to, I'd say, man, we're probably, from when we were in its heyday, we're probably 30% of what it was. I mean,
the activity.
Yeah, I mean, it's like it's not as much. So, you know, it's interesting. We talk about like the Kentucky Par. And like, and some of those types of brands. And it's fascinating because those are creeping up as the secondary is kind of coming down. And so the pricing that was being realized in secondary market is now being pushed into retails through various, you know, forms. And it's kind of fascinating from a value proposition in terms of like economies. And I'm fascinated by this whole subject, but I kind of want to throw it to you, Kenny.
Everybody wants to throw it to each other.
Yeah, right?
No. hot potato.
Hey, this is secondary market. What is this? But we've said it before, secondary market is whack-a-mole, you know, but I feel like it's not gone. It's not going to be gone, but it is pretty, it's been hit pretty hard. And I feel like it's just kind of like humming along barely. I mean, where are we in terms of the health of the secondary market?
Well, I wish I could give you a good gauge of it, but I think we were talking before here is like we don't really get invited to those groups anymore. I think the spotlight might be a little bit too big on us. But you know, I am still part of some groups, and that's just, I enjoy it. I enjoy just watching what happens, what people are talking about, what people are going for. And God, just goes back to the very beginning. Like, it's market data, and it really is. And you look at it, and there is a little bit of enjoyment just watching something happen. If I had to put a label on it, I'd say it's probably on crutches. Like, that's probably the best way to put it. And the fact that you will never see another group like BSM again. That was one of my, I think, gosh, was that a 2021 thing that I was like, oh yeah, this is going to come back and it's be bigger than ever. And I'll eat my words on that one because it's definitely not. And it's
the right rapper one, right, though.
Yeah, I got that one. So, but I mean, it's just one of those things where, again, I think it hurts because, as we mentioned before, it is part of bourbon culture. It is part of what grew this. And I think Facebook, it built bourbon and it killed bourbon all in one fell swoop. It got a lot of people into it. It made people more aware of brands. Do I think it'll ever go away? No, I think.
Yeah, I don't think it can.
I think even as distilleries today are pumping out, gosh, what, you know, look at the big boys that are doing anywhere between 1,000 to 12 to upwards of 1,500 barrels a day, and they're filling 50,000 barrel warehouses every 4 to 6 months. If we think like, gosh, in 10 years, is Eagle Rare and Blanton's just going to be lined up on the shelves?
Nope, it's just going to be in Europe and China.
Good way to put it.
And never.
That's what I was saying. Well, maybe it will. However, there is always going to be a market for the highly desirable and highly allocated.
Yeah.
And that's not going to end. So the idea that even though we are putting away tens of thousands of hundreds of thousands of barrels every single year between all the distilleries across the United States, and there's that one special barrel that everybody's going after, it's still going to exist and people are still going to want it.
Yeah. And I'm sad about the secondary market not being, you know, before we went on, I was like, man, I'm really just out of touch with secondary because it's been so difficult to, you know, stay a part of it with the shutdowns and, you know, micro groups and this and that and having to be invited and whatnot. But
being uniformly hated.
Being uniformly hated as well. But I miss it because I remember just being on the couch and mindlessly scrolling through it, looking at what stuff would go through and what people liked. And you're like, really? That's what people like? And then you're like, well, maybe they weren't stupid. You know, I was the stupid one. And, you know, it's definitely such a valuable tool for this hobby and this industry. I hate that it's not there. And there'll be some kind of secondary market. There has to be because there's only so many limited releases to go around. And, you know, and if you got one, it's going to be more valuable to someone. And there has to be a channel or avenue to get it to them. I just wish we could all work together to make it a viable win-win solution for everyone involved.
And I think the things are in motion with the GoPuff kind of like acquisition, and like somewhere between the brick and mortar and what Drizzly's doing and what like Sealbox is doing, somewhere between those three will be a legal solution to what the secondary market is. And I believe that at some point we will see an individual kind of like license to be able to sell alcohol directly to someone else. I believe that will come on board at some point. Currently, federally, it's kind of like, you know, while Kentucky and like North Carolina have like vintage laws and DC has vintage laws, the federal mandate still is, you know, pushes out every now and then, like you have to have a license to sell alcohol to someone, or you have to buy it within the three-tier system. But it's much like marijuana, states like having marijuana sales. It's still against the federal code, but they're still doing it. So it's kind of like, look the other way. I still believe and hope that we have a legal means that can be the secondary market. I have never sold anything. You know, I've bought a lot. I've met people in parking lots with sacks full of cash. I've met in alleys at 8 o'clock at night as the sun is setting in Bardstown. Come to think of it, I've done a lot of stupid things to buy a bourbon. But I know that those were people that purchased them somewhere through an estate sale or something, and they were valuable to me. So as a purchaser, as someone who is excited to find bottles that I know I can't get in retail, there is a place. I think there is a place there. But I go to this because it's, you know, the Mark Browns of the world, they hate the secondary market. And so if there ever can be a way where we can channel this into, you know, being legal, I think that's the way to go. I think sometimes we vilify the wrong people in a system, but we really do need to try to get it into a legal means so I don't have to meet people in parking lots anymore with cash.
I do miss when there wasn't a release would come out and you would go and see that night, like people, you know, they got it that day and you'd see what it's priced at and you're like, oh, what's it going to do? Is it going to go up or down or this and that? And then people try and they're like, oh, it's going down, down. And
first movers in the market. And it's like, oh, pull away, pull away. Let's go ahead. We'll end it on that note, because I think, Fred, when you talk about making a legal market or a legal avenue is exactly the way that we should do it and not vilify the people or not look at companies and say they're doing something wrong or they should be doing better or anything like that. I think if you try to fight a community that already exists, you're just going to end up fighting an uphill battle and that's mm-hmm. what's going to happen. So that's going to end it for part two of Is Bourbon Broken? And we talked about the secondary. Stay tuned for the next episode in the series where we're going to talk about distribution and retail.
Can't wait.
Gets even spicier.
And this is where vodka sucks.
Yes, it does.
So make sure you follow Bourbon Pursuit wherever you get your podcast and follow us as well on all the socials. Make sure you follow our buddy over here, Fred Minnick, on YouTube and all his socials as well. But with that, cheers, everybody, and we'll see you next time.